Philip Morgan.
Listening with a Real, how are you?
I'm doing well, my friend. I have a gripe about LinkedIn, Philip. I have many gripes about LinkedIn, but do you want to hear my latest one?
I'm shocked. I'm not sure I can handle this amount of negativity. No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Why are you shocked?
I'm being totally sarcastic, man. Of course, there's a million gripes with LinkedIn or any major platform, but what's got your goat today?
Well, I'll tell you what has my goat, Philip Morgan. What has my goat is two things. So on LinkedIn, you can't publish a thumbnail for your video, which means it just shows the first frame, right?
Okay.
So that's what people see if they're scrolling through their feed.
Yeah.
And so I would take the time to go and create a thumbnail as the first frame before I export my video. And LinkedIn was cutting that off. It's done it twice where it doesn't publish the first frame, which is mystifying to me. I'm not sure how that's happening.
Do you think that they're targeting you? They're singling you out?
For being too awesome for the platform?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Or just like, whoa, we got to up the bar for this guy. He's having too easy of a time getting attention on our platform.
You know, it pains me to admit this publicly, but yes, I did think I might be too awesome.
You felt targeted.
No, I didn't at all.
Reverse discrimination.
I just chalked it up to inconsistent and possibly slightly faulty software.
Sure, that's the much more likely explanation.
And then secondly, when you upload a video, you can add subtitles. You can paste a little file, and LinkedIn is supposed to merge the two. So it shows closed captions.
Oh, that happens in LinkedIn. Interesting. Got it.
Well, it can. That's not how I've done it before. I burn the captions onto the video. So like if you played the video on your desktop, you'd see them.
Yeah.
So I do it this other way today. And of course, it doesn't work. No captions on my video. And gripe number three, and then I'll gripe about something completely different, which is the topic today. Gripe number three was, I can't now go back to my post and replace the video. I'd have to take the post down and redo the video if I wanted to have it with captions.
I think I know what the problem there is, but what's the problem with just deleting the post and doing another one?
Well, because I have likes and comments and inertia behind it, and I promote it, and right? So like any momentum that it would have gained is gone, and I have to start over and sort of apologize. Like, by the way, I did this last week, but LinkedIn screwed it up, so here we go again.
They call that the French exit.
Tell me about that.
Hey, have you ever heard that term before?
No.
It's when you like leave a gathering or social gathering or party without saying goodbye. They call it the French exit.
That's the only way my wife and I leave parties.
Me too.
We're sort of like, we don't need to do the, it's sort of like the encores at a concert. Like, it's just a charade. We all know what the deal is. Like, it was nice to see you. If we didn't talk, we don't need to go through the, hey, let's catch up and have lunch soon. It's like, well, you would have said that earlier if you really wanted to do that, but okay.
Right. Wow. So, okay, A, you now have the proper label for what you do, and B, that's also my preferred way to leave a gathering is just duck out while nobody's looking.
Well, we don't like these drawn out goodbyes. My wife and I both agree on that. And like when we get in the car, that would be our series of gripes is like, can you believe, like, why do we have to do that every time?
Wow. I did not know we had this in common, Liston.
We do.
It's a beautiful thing.
And I've learned two new sayings from you today. French exit and by the goat. What's got you by the goat?
What got your goat?
Yeah, okay.
It must be a Southern thing. I heard the greatest saying. My wife and I love watching British TV. We heard the saying, that's about as useful as an ashtray on a motorcycle.
Oh, that's funny. While we're on this topic, I'll share one with you. My friend Greg was in a meeting one time with a guy from like the deep south, and he used the phrase, I was madder than a mosquito in a mannequin factory.
That's awesome. I'm going to have to start using those. I keep a list of these funny sayings.
Yeah, that's probably the funniest saying that I've ever heard. And also, it's like so thoughtful. It works on so many different levels.
That is really clever. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Whew.
All right. Well, so Philip, on to my gripe that is the topic of the show today. So I've had some calls with prospects. You know that I'm on the phone a lot with people.
All the time.
And one of the questions I always ask if a firm clearly isn't differentiated in their marketing or specialized, as you would say, or positioned, I'm guessing you see nuance in these words, but basically it's not obvious who they serve and what they do and what's different about them. And that's really common. And I think we've had maybe on the podcast or off the podcast, we've talked about, or I've mentioned to you that I don't see a lot of big companies that are very narrowly niched. And I have thoughts about why that's the case and how they deal with that. But if you're a team of 5 or 10 or even 100, it probably makes sense to at least pick a customer type by which the customer would self-identify. So maybe that's industry, maybe that's business model, like whatever it is, there's going to be ways that customers would self-segment and self-identify and say, oh, this must be for me. So that's what I would say by what I mean. So I'm always asking people, hey, I notice I'm not sure exactly who you serve or kind of why you're different. Can you tell me about that? And here's the answer I've gotten from many people, and I'm sure you've heard it, Philip. They say, well, our specialty is that we're generalists. And I'm like, okay, can you tell me more about that and like how you were able to reach that conclusion? And they say, well, one thing we bring to the table is every time we go into engagement, because we have this general skill set, we can solve any new problem that we see.
Okay.
And I always say, and tell me how that's a benefit to the client. What do you think about that? I mean, have you heard this very thing before?
I maybe haven't heard it from others because they know what's coming if they try to pull that shit with me.
Right, because you're the positioning police and I'm not.
Right. So what I get more often is people apologizing for having a generalist position. I mean, they sort of do it in a pseudo-theatrical way. Like they know that the goal, if you're going to work with me, is to get out of that position as quickly, but also as pragmatically as possible. So, I mean, they kind of apologize. But here's the thing is I've said in previous like chapters of my career before I sort of got it about specialization and positioning, I've said those almost those same words myself. Maybe not our specialty is that we're general, because that's sort of stupid, or I wouldn't have said that, or that's just a little too clever or something. But I would have said, it's this huge asset that I have this cross-disciplinary strength or something like that. I would have dressed it up like that.
And I agree with you. I think the main reason you don't hear it is because people talk to you to improve their positioning. So they've already acknowledged.
Yeah, there's a selection bias at play is why I don't hear that.
Well, they're already past the sort of awareness
yeah.
and the problem awareness stage where they go, oh yeah, this is a problem. I want help. Philip's the guy to help me.
Totally.
So,
but I do have things to say about that, just so you know, I have opinions. Anyway, go ahead.
About which part?
Oh, about like maybe we shouldn't dismiss it so fast and say, oh, it's just there is something there. And I'd love to get to talking about that. But I cut you off. Go ahead with what you were going to say.
Well, that's why we have the podcast, right? Is to dig into these things. So I do want to dig into it because it got me thinking, why am I having such a visceral reaction to that statement? Because I was sort of like pissed off. Like, why are you pulling the wool over my eyes? Like, you think that I can't see right through your bullshit? And I found it very ironic coming from the owner of a marketing firm to say that. I've been trying to think a little bit more deeply about, well, what is the problem here?
Yeah.
So why don't we talk a little bit about what a generalist and a specialist is? But I do want to say, I think this is the thing that bothered me the most, is if you want to be a generalist, that's cool. Like I said, some of the biggest consulting companies in the world are pretty general. I mean, Bain, McKinsey, Accenture, they're not niched, right? They're do-all everything management consulting firms.
Yeah.
Same thing with Sapient and Razorfish just merged. I'm sure they'll serve anybody with the budget.
Yeah. So for the folks at home who are maybe feeling like there's mixed messaging or mixed signals coming from Liston and I, we're both generally fans of specializing, which is the thing you do, that's the cause. And then over time, the effect is you develop a reputation for doing something specific or serving a specific industry. That reputation is your market position. Like you can create a reputation with a multi-million-dollar advertising budget. We don't have that. So we just have to focus, specialize, and do it over a long enough period of time that the reputation builds up around us. So real quick, just definition of terms.
Yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
On the one hand, we're fans of that, but I'm about to say that for certain companies, quote unquote specializing in being a generalist is fine. And I'm going to explain why. And that may sound like mixed signals, but the all important thing here is the context. There is a context or multiple contexts in which a generalist company is fine. It might even be preferred or win out over a specialized business for specific reasons. And one is unsophisticated buyers don't want to manage a team of specialists, work and coordinate their efforts. Not only do they not want to, they'd probably make a real mess of it because they're unsophisticated buyers. They are, I don't know, let's think of like in high school, I had a friend and his dad was a wealthy dude who owned this sort of general services company that did janitorial landscaping and security services. It was a regional business and he made a ton of money. I think even a business like that is not going to want to hire a team, like coordinate a sales specialist like Liston, another specialist who maybe focuses just on pay-per-click advertising. Even a business like that is going to prefer to hire exactly, perhaps Liston, the kind of marketing agency you just put your finger on, the one that quote-unquote specializes in being a generalist, because they can legitimately say, we will do your website, your pay-per-click, your SEO, your branding. What else would they add to that list? I think I've covered some of the big ones.
Yeah, logos, graphic design, social media.
Email marketing, maybe.
Yes.
They'll just have this umbrella called marketing.
Mailers, videos, sure.
Right. Oh, yeah, print advertising, billboards, stuff like
basically
that.
Basically anything you ask for that you think is related to marketing, they'll say yes to.
Right. And I'm a big advocate for people like us, I'll just say that, getting away from that because the competitive dynamics of serving that kind of customer are so crappy. There's such a race to the bottom dynamic. There's so many other things. As a solo person or a very small business, you're going to be pulled in too many different directions if you're trying to do that many things. But there is a situation where that's actually a competitive advantage, is serving this very unsophisticated buyer of, let's say, marketing services for this example. The other context where it makes sense is if you're McKinsey, if you're Bain, if you're whoever, if you're Deloitte. First of all, usually people who are hiring those companies are not hiring the whole company. They're hiring a division of McKinsey or Deloitte or whatever.
Probably individual people, like little micro consulting firms internally, right? They have relationships with people. And also I would say, what you can't tell from the outside in most of those cases is, I guarantee you, Bain, McKinsey, BCG, Accenture, pick your large firm, they're doing segmented content marketing to industries, to specific problems, to specific solutions and strategies that they can implement. There is niching and specialization within their marketing. We just can't see it externally.
Right. Because you're not in that segment. I wonder that sometimes when I'm on the email list of more sophisticated marketers, I'm interested in what they're doing. And I'm always like, Ramit Sethi would be an example of this. I'm like, I bet I'm not seeing more than 20% of the content he emails out because it's all using this sort of behavioral profiling to segment me. And so I'm just seeing the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. I think you're right about that. But their size is a competitive advantage because it speaks to the risk question that more sophisticated buyers have. And also they know that they can bring a variety of things to this one point of contact. And in a way, McKinsey or Deloitte, it's almost like an umbrella company over a bunch of smaller companies.
Exactly.
But the umbrella company can pull in resources from other parts of their other divisions, if you will, and do this full service thing. Those are the two situations where this kind of specializing in being a generalist makes sense. It really does. And I'm not here to argue against those. But I think the idea that you can show up as a generalist and be as effective as a specialist is laughable outside of those contexts.
There we go. Now we're getting to it.
That's the Philip you expected to hear.
I need you to use harsher language from now on.
I would like to mock that idea. I like listeners to be crying at the end of this podcast if they hold that idea.
I think you've arrived at the crux of it for me. My feeling was, hey, if you want to be a generalist, no big deal, but don't pretend as if that is somehow some sort of strong differentiation, because I go to your website and it looks like every other marketing company that I see, right? Like, here's a whole list of stuff we do.
I want to encourage us to be as empathetic as we can here. Did you ever, though, in your previous part of your career, feel like the same way, have kind of the same viewpoint where you're like, what's special about us is we're so versatile and so flexible and have such this broad background. That's what makes us unique. Because I did at one point have that feeling, and I'm curious if you did too.
I don't think I thought that exact thing, but I know for sure I was scared to commit to a customer type on my website, which was dumb because we mainly served one or two types of customers, and I could have put that on the website and it would have been a much more powerful message. I thought that at the time, focusing on copywriting and CRO was a strong enough differentiator. Obviously, it's not now.
Sure.
Because it's been completely commoditized.
Yeah.
And also I would have focused more on sort of the broader category and the customer problem in retrospect. But yeah, I don't think I felt like being a generalist was some sort of specialized advantage. You know, I didn't want to commit, which I'm sure you encounter all the time.
Oh yeah, totally. That's probably the more common thing. But I did this myself, so I feel like I should try to be fair to people who are currently doing to themselves. And I think what I did was I talked myself into believing that this broad jack of all trades thing was a superpower. It was like, oh, we can handle anything. And that's a superpower. But if you stack up that person against a real specialist in any one of those areas where they consider themselves a jack of all trades, it is embarrassing. The difference is embarrassing. I can't say this strongly enough. It makes you feel like amateur is the wrong word, because there's a meaning to amateur, which is you do something for the love of it. You feel like a fuck up compared to a real expert. You feel like an incompetent fraud when you really put yourself side by side with a real expert. And I'm not talking about someone who has 30 years of experience. A real expert, 2 to 3 years of focus can make somebody a real expert, especially when you stack them up side by side with someone who is doing what I used to do. Again, I want to emphasize, I used to be in this camp of like, oh, it's my superpower is I can do all these different things. And the level of expertise at which I did them, the level of excellence at which I did them, was laughably bad compared to a true expert.
So one of the things that I thought was ironic is when this came out during the conversation, well, our specialty or our differentiator is that we're undifferentiated.
Yeah,
right. What he said. And I said, okay, well, let me ask you another question. And I think we've talked about this on the podcast. I said, tell me tomorrow you want help with business development. You want more leads. Who do we go talk to?
Yeah, I've started a workshop in the past with that same question. I've like, you've got 5 minutes. I want you to build for me a list of 10 ideal clients. And the feeling that people have at the end of those 5 minutes is often despair, or it's like a reality check. Anyway, I love that you did that. What happened next?
So first there was silence, extended silence. And then there was this discussion of, well, I really want clients who have budgets and see things the way we do. And it's like, okay, great, perfect.
Love that one.
Okay, so how do we go find them?
I know you've got some gripes with LinkedIn, but they just, on LinkedIn Sales Navigator, added a filter called has budget and won't push back against my advice and is easy to work with. It's the greatest thing ever.
Worldview and internal values. I like that. We'll just include that.
If
on
the
LinkedIn.
Folks at home can't hear the sarcasm dripping from my voice, I'm not doing a good enough job.
So that came up, but then he quickly assured me that he could make a list tomorrow. And I said, okay, no worries. Well, the problem that I see is you're a team of four. I'm talking to this guy now. You're a team of four, and you want to go out and get more leads, and you're not willing to sort of narrow your focus, you're going to have to create new collateral and messaging for everybody, or you're just going to go out and talk about all the stuff you can do, which I promise you no one really cares about.
Right. What they'll be doing is a variation of responding to RFPs. There may not be a formal RFP on the table, but the dynamics will be pretty similar to responding to RFPs, where essentially it'll be sort of like an impromptu RFP, right? They'll figure out, they'll sort of smell that some client might need something or might routinely spend money on their type of company. And then they'll say, okay, well, tell us about what you need. And that'll be the client sort of verbalizing the RFP, and they'll do their damnedest to just have a big green check mark in every checkbox the client puts there.
Yes.
Regardless of whether it's good for anybody to do that.
So this is what came out. They had all of these, he says, we have all these deals in the pipeline and we have 15 or 20 of them. He goes, you know, maybe we'll close one or two. And I was like, well, are they really deals then? You only expect to close 5%? Why are you considering them deals? Oh, well, we have one phone conversation. We find out what they need. And then we send them a list of our services and estimate the price. And I thought, well, there's no buy-in whatsoever from the other person, right?
That sounds like the odds that salmon swimming upstream have.
Well, you know what it sounds like is me going to my favorite barbecue place and ordering chicken off the menu. I mean, it's like you're not a specialist or a consultant. You're just an order filler.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing.
Right. And them running to wherever they get their supplies and saying, oh, you'd need some chicken because this guy asked for it.
Right. Exactly.
And then them going on the internet and Googling how to make barbecue chicken.
Yes. They're project managing people from Upwork, more or less, which is, again, totally fine. You can make money in that model, but you can't command your own prices and you can't make a really large margin in that model. It's just not the way it works.
Again, for the folks at home who are like, holy crap, these guys sound like they're pissed off.
We are, Philip. Take responsibility for your feelings.
The Two Angry Men podcast. So, wait, I think I've just lifted that accidentally from something I heard somebody else say. Anyway, until you have experienced firsthand or maybe just seen somebody else and be like, why do they get so much money for their projects compared to me? Like, until you've been that close to the alternative, you don't really know there's another way. And you don't know what that other way feels like. And it feels like being able to read your prospective client's mind half the time or more. It feels like commanding the room in a sales conversation. It feels totally different. And most people find that feeling, frankly, addictive once they've tasted it. It's what's the most addictive substance? Maybe heroin. It's like on that level of addictiveness.
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting because I'm starting to learn more how to use my sales process as a way to sell my sales training. And so I'll say, like, how did it feel when I did this?
Right.
And they'll go, oh yeah, like I didn't even think about that. And I'll tell them, hey, when you asked me, what do? I started off by listing off the problems that I can solve for clients. And you were nodding your head along. And that's only because I'm specialized.
Right. Yeah.
I already know what's going on with you, or at least at a high likelihood, you're going to have a few problems on this list. I know that.
Yeah.
Right?
That's the mind reading part. Yep.
Right. I've talked to hundreds of people like you. More than that, actually. Thousands. Right?
And you've seen some patterns. You can't help. You don't have to be intelligent to do this stuff. That's the wonderful part about it. You don't have to be eloquent. You don't have to have a charismatic personality, even though you have all those things listed. It's...
Oh, stop it. Oh, stop, Philip.
But those things are like, I mean, obviously you have to be somewhat together, but you don't have to have all those things.
Well, I think you bring up a good point. I started my sales training business basically at the end of December. I decided what it was going to look like and what I was going to pursue. And I've been making little tweaks along the way. But in 5 months, the amount I have learned is tremendous. I mean, you can disagree with me, but I feel like this has been the most progress I've ever made in 6 months and probably anything I've ever done in my life. And one of the big reasons I would attribute that to is focus.
Yeah. All you did was said, I'm going to look at the same thing over and over again. Instead of, I'm going to look at as many diverse things as possible. So that's it. I'm going to have to go in a minute or two to get to my next thing. Sorry, I had to shoehorn this in. But I think we compensated with the intensity of our emotion around this.
I think so. I think you, dear listener, understand that we really mean this stuff. We really mean it.
We do. And again, I have empathy for what it's like to be in sort of pre-enlightenment, if you will, about the value of specialization. There's also, I hope I acknowledge adequately, it's not for everybody. There's ways to succeed without it. But if you're like us, if you're running a small business, it's just you or you and a small team, it's a superpower that you owe it to yourself to give it a fair shake.
I think in order to reach that stage of having a price premium, getting the lead generation machine working, having continuity in the sales and marketing that you do, all of these things, I'm not telling you you can't be a generalist. I'm not saying that at all. But I just want you to acknowledge what you are and what the ramifications are if you're a generalist or a specialist. Here's where I'd leave it. Arnold Schwarzenegger. You've heard of this person, right, Philip?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you put forward this idea of picking a thing and becoming known for it to a small focus group of people. Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he started his career, bodybuilder, what is that? Very small sliver of people in the world knew what that was. That led him to get movie roles. Movie roles eventually led him to have huge business opportunities. Business opportunities and his popularity led him to become governor. So it's not to say that if you choose a specialization, you have to be known for that thing forever, but you have to start somewhere to become known and start commanding that price premium. So I'll leave it there. Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yep. It's not like getting a tattoo on your forehead. And also, now you know, fair warning, if you're getting on the phone with Liston and you're going to say you're specialized as a generalist, you know what's coming.
Bad things.
See you later, buddy.
All right, man. Bye.
Bye.